Well, good morning, everyone. It's lovely to be with you. It's nice to see some faces that I'm not familiar with. My name's Tim. I'm the pastor at Wheelock Heath Baptist Church, where most of these guys came from originally, but a lot of you have joined since, and that's really lovely to see. I'm going to be sharing with you a bit of the book of Exodus. We've been studying that at Wheelock Heath Baptist Church, and really the purpose of the book of Exodus is basically what that song says. It's to show how great thou art, how great God is. And we see lots of things about God's character. Now, just to let you know, it's a little bit different to how we normally do things. I'm going to be preaching on quite a big chunk of Exodus. So I'm going to be preaching from Exodus 15:22 all the way to 18:27. So if you do not have a Bible in your hands right now, stick your hand in the air, and I'm going to nominate who's standing around here. Someone, oh, what a servant-hearted man. Anybody want a Bible, stick your hand in the air, and Jay's going to give you one. Don't be shy. He's got up there. No, are you sure? Thank you, Carol. Well done. You're going to need one, I promise you, because we're going to be going through a big section. We didn't read it all then. And it's lovely to be with you once again. Hope you're going to appreciate what we hear, God's word. Yeah. Maybe we need some bigger ones, hey? Oh, there you go, Brenda. Got one there from Beth. Right, Exodus chapter 15, verse 22. If you have your eyes there, we'll be coming to that in a second. But before we go there, let me say to you, or ask you, who do you trust to come through for you when you really need it? When you've got an emergency and you need someone right now, who is the first person you call? Maybe the person in your mind is your parents. Mum or dad, always the first to call. And maybe it's your husband or your wife. Maybe it's a close friend who you can always rely upon. Who's the person you turn to for help? Well, top of the list for a Christian should be God. Our first port of call in danger or suffering or anxiety should be the Lord of heaven and earth. We should trust God to provide for us, to give us what we need, whatever such situation we face. And yet it sometimes feels that God doesn't come through. You might have noticed, if you've been around Christians for a while, that life doesn't get easier when you become a Christian. Being a Christian doesn't make you immune to suffering. Many of us feel like life has got harder since we've become Christians. Perhaps sometimes even because we're Christians. Can we trust God to provide for us in any circumstances like we can trust those people that are close to us? Well, at this point in the story of Exodus, we're right on the tail of the victory at the Red Sea. Most of you will know the story. They come to the Red Sea, the sea is parted, Israel go through. They're rescued from Egypt. Egypt's armies are covered with the waves. And you'd be forgiven as an Israelite for thinking at this point, all the suffering is over. It's all finished. Suffering will happen to us no more. And yet the very next thing that happens after they sing a song of praise to God is that they're greeted with suffering. Thirst and hunger are no minor thing when you're traveling through the desert. Yet this is what Israel face here. Straight after being rescued, they face suffering. They begin to wonder whether God can really come through for them after all. What was God teaching them in the midst of their trials? And what is God saying to us who face the very same situation, being rescued but suffering nonetheless? Well, we see five ways in this big chunk that God provides for his people and provides for those of us who trust in Jesus as well. Firstly, we see in chapter 15, verses 22 to 27, that God provides in trials. As I've just said, put yourself in Israel's shoes. Imagine that you've walked through the Red Sea. You've been rescued in this miraculous way. You'd be forgiven for thinking that from this point onwards, it's all plain sailing. But it doesn't take long before they're in need. Look at 15 verse 22. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert, without finding water. few of us here know what it's like to be in the desert. Maybe some of you have taken a trip to Dubai or something like that. And I know for certain that none of you will have hiked across a desert carrying the wealth of Egypt on your backs and taking no water with you. That would be a horrendous thing to do. And yet this is what is happening to Israel here. So don't push this aside as, oh, what a silly little moan. This is a horrendous thing to go through. Imagine then their joy. They find water. They come to this place called Marah in verse 32. But they find out they can't drink the water because it's bitter. And that's basically the straw that broke the camel's back. The people get very frustrated. We're told in verse 24, the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink?" Now, I wonder whether the word grumbled is the most helpful translation, because I don't know about you, but when I think of a grumble, I think of someone sort of muttering under their breath, "Oh dear, these people are taking us to a place without water. What are they doing?" Mumble, mumble, mumble. But that's not what's going on here. They're grumbling against Moses. They're going to him. It's very aggressive, this complaint. Later in the next few chapters, we're going to hear that same word being used when Israel are planning to stone Moses to death. This is aggressive. It's not just muttering under their breaths. They're really angry. And it's unsurprising, I guess, given the circumstances. They think they and their entire family are going to die. It's not wrong to suffer. It's not even wrong to have complaints in suffering. What's wrong here is where that complaint is directed. Their complaint is directed to Moses rather than to God. What they should have done is what Moses' reaction is. Verse 25, then Moses cried out to the Lord. That's the right response to times of trial. And immediately, as Moses turns to the Lord answers. Verse 25, Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became fit to drink. The Lord provides the instant Israel turned to God in prayer. Yet the Lord has something more to teach them in this event than just, "I can provide water to you." He goes on to give them a bit of a test, a bit of a challenge. He says in that third paragraph, midway through verse 25, there the Lord issued a ruling and instruction for them and put them to the test. He said, if you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. God proposes a test. He tells them this kind of thing is going to happen again, which we'll see. They must listen carefully to the Lord and do what's right in his eyes. So lashing out against Moses isn't the right response. They're to cry out to the Lord. They're to rely on him. And if they do that, God promises to heal them because he is the healing God. And to prove that, he takes them to Elim. In verse 27, a beautiful place with 12 springs and 70 palm trees. The perfect place for the nation of Israel to rest and recuperate in the middle of this desert. Quite literally, an oasis. God takes them there to teach them that he will provide for them in all the trials they go through. Now, we have to be careful about how we apply verse 26 to ourselves. Some Christians have taken this story as evidence that God will heal Christians of any disease that they happen to have. But this passage was spoken to Israel and not to us. There's slight differences now between the way God relates to his people and the way he related to those in the Old Testament. Paul in the New Testament, who no one would argue was an unfaithful man, had a thorn in the flesh that God told him he would not heal despite Paul's prayer. God didn't promise to take the suffering away from Paul, but what he did promise was, my grace is sufficient for you. While the condition may linger for Paul, God will provide the grace to endure it. And that's what you and I need to know.
we need to know that God provides in our trials. It might be God provides healing for our illness or reconciliation for our relationships or whatever it is we feel we need. But it might be that God gives us the grace to endure that suffering. Whatever the case, we need to learn that the lesson that trials are a test of whether we will trust God to come through for us. When you suffer, do you trust God to provide? Or do you cry out to him as Moses did? Or do you lash out at others around who you believe are to blame? Well, that's the first thing that we see. And then straight on the heels, we have a second test, just as God promised. And in chapter 16, which we read most of before, we hear that God provides our daily needs. It's clear the Israelites didn't learn their lesson. Not long after leaving Elim, they're complaining to Moses again, this time for not giving them food. So have a look at chapter 16, verse 3. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat round pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you've brought us out into this desert to starve the entire assembly to death." Now you might think, hang on, what are they saying here? Firstly, they say, if only we'd died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. Apparently death is better than being alive and suffering in this situation. But even more surprising is the way that they characterize their life in Egypt. If you've read this story, you'll know that they had their children murdered. They were forced into slave labor, yet apparently it was the time of their lives. You might think to yourself, do you not remember how bad Egypt was, Israel? But aren't we like that too? Do you ever look back to your life before Jesus? When life just seemed to be that little bit easier? Or perhaps you look back to a time before God had called you to a great sacrifice and think, oh, wasn't it so much better then? Wasn't it so much better when I didn't have to do this ministry at church, which is really hard work? Wasn't it so much better when I didn't have to go through the awkwardness of telling my friends and family about Jesus? We can easily do the same thing. We can look back on our old way of life. I think it was so much greater. God had warned them that they were going to face these trials. He told them that they were to come to him in their times of need. And yet, instantly, the first test, they fail. Moses rightly points out to them that while he's the one they're complaining to, the one they're truly complaining against is God. Chapter 16, verse 8. Moses also said, "You will know that it was the Lord when he gives you meat to eat in the evening and all the bread you want in the morning, because he has heard your grumbling against him." Who are we? You are not grumbling against us, but against the Lord's. Now, if you were listening to that as an Israelite, you might say, well, hang on, we never said anything about God. We're complaining about you. But Moses says, you're not really complaining against me. You're complaining against the Lord. If God is in charge of every circumstance that arises in our lives, then any complaint is truly against him. Perhaps you're frustrated in your life right now because you've got a boss who overworks you. Or you've got a family member who always lets you down. Or there's someone at church who always seems to get your back up. Or who always wants to drag things in a slightly different direction to you. But it's God who's decided that that person should be in your life. He's given you this trial in the hope that you will depend on him more as a result of this situation. If you only vent your frustration towards a particular individual, rather than turn to the Lord in prayer, then it's God you're grumbling against. Now, what you'd expect God to say right now is, right, Israel, you've had your warning. I told you I was going to test you. You failed that test, so no food for you. But as we saw in the children's talk, that's not the way God responds to human sinfulness. He actually gives them exactly what they said they had in Egypt. They talk about how they had so much meat in Egypt. So God makes quail fall from the sky. They say, oh, we ate all the food we wanted in Egypt. So he provides manna, which we're told in verse 18, was enough that everyone had as much as they needed. God shows them that he can provide anything they think they had in Egypt. Yet inbuilt in this miracle is a new lesson for Israel. The manna from heaven, the bread from heaven, is going to come every day. But they're not to keep a little bit aside for the next day. Every day, the Israelites are to go to bed with no food in the cupboard. They're to rely day after day on the Lord providing. The only exception to that is on the sixth day, where they're to rely on God to provide them enough food to last them through 2 days. This was a test inbuilt to make them trust God. Now, if you know anything about Israel in the Old Testament, you won't be surprised that many of them failed. We read in verse 20 that some of them decided they were going to keep a little bit just in case God forgot to rain manna down the next day. And God made it get full of maggots and begin to smell. And then we find in verse 27 that some of them didn't trust God to let the food last 2 days. So they went out on the Sabbath morning just in case any manna had rained from heaven. And they found none. In both instances, we see these people failing to trust God. Now, you and I aren't dependent on God to rain down manna from heaven. But there are many times that we're called to trust him day by day by day. Jesus talks to his disciples in the Sermon on the Mount about food and clothing, which were needs that they had. And he said, "Don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own." And in that same sermon, he teaches them the prayer that many of us know as the Lord's Prayer. Inbuilt in that is a prayer for our daily bread. Jesus still calls his people to trust God for daily provision, even if it's not manna. If you're going through a time of suffering, I suspect that you'll find that your troubles don't come in neat little boxes. They all come in one big hit, don't they? Your mum's in hospital, your son's getting bad grades at school, your boss is expecting you to do double the work in half the time, and to top it all, you had an argument with your husband or wife before you came out this morning. When you look at that, when you look at all the problems you have, when you look at a week, a month, a year, even a lifetime's worth of suffering, it's not surprising that we get overwhelmed. But if we just trust God to give enough for us to get through this one day, and the next day, and the next day, and the day after that, eventually you'll reach a point when you'll look back over weeks and months and years and see all the ways God provided for you. God provides our daily bread. Now, you'd have thought at this stage that the Israelites have finally learnt their lesson. But in chapter 17, verses 1 to 7, they're complaining again. Tells you a lot about human sinfulness, doesn't it? And here we see that God provides more than we deserve. Once again, verse 2, they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses calls them out again. He says, "You're complaining against God, take it to God." But this time, their attack is so aggressive that Moses is fearful for his life. Yet he wisely once again turns to the Lord. Verse 4, "What am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me." The Lord then gives him an answer, which must have been quite a challenge. He says, first of all, "Go out in front of the people." That doesn't sound like a big deal, but remember, they wanted to stone him. Moses probably wanted to be the other side of the desert from them. And then he tells them in verses 5 to 6, Moses, "Take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. I will stand before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the people and water will come out of it for the people to drink." Strike the rock, what did I say? Did I say strike the people? Well, I'm just checking you're listening. Oh dear, thank you, Brenda. Now, it's interesting what happens there. They've gathered all the people and the elders. This is a court scene. Now, you might think that on that rock should be the people. I certainly do. Because they're the ones who haven't done what God has said. They should stand on trial for their rejection of God. It's not them on the rock. The Israelites would have liked Moses to be on the rock because they're convinced that despite the fact that he's prayed to God twice and provided for them twice, he's the worst leader they've ever had. But Moses isn't the one on the rock either. Who is going to stand on that rock? Verse 6, I will stand there before you at the rock of Horeb. And what happens to that rock? It is struck. God stands on the rock and is struck. Paul tells us in the New Testament that the rock from which the water flowed at this event is Christ. As the rock had to be struck for water to flow, so similarly for us, God himself, Christ, had to be struck for eternal life to flow. Both originally at the rock of Horeb and now for us, God is stricken so that his people can be forgiven. God provides vastly more than we deserve. When the New Testament talks about Israel in the desert, often it uses this event as a warning to us. We're not to be like the people of Israel. We're not to be a people who moan and groan about everything that doesn't go our way. If suffering comes upon us, or there's challenges in church life, or spiritual life is difficult, we aren't to go around complaining like Israel, but we're to trust in God. If you're moaning and quarreling in your Christian life, this is a message from the Lord to you. Stop right now. Yet we must recognize that we are just like Israel. We fail repeatedly, time and time again. And what's our only hope when we fail? Well, our only hope is that God was struck instead of us. Look at what we've seen so far in this book, in these passages. They're told they must obey God's voice. They're told to trust him. And they don't. And they don't again. And if you read through the next book of the Bible, Numbers, you'll find out they do the same thing again. This is all of Israel's history. And yet grace still comes time and time again. Why? Not because they're getting better, not because they've done some good things that have outweighed the bad, but because of the grace of God, that God was stricken instead of them. Now we can trust that like Israel, we won't get treated as we deserve. We can gripe and moan against God and his people. We can sin time and time again. We can fail to trust him in the midst of the difficulties we face. We can be the ones who deserve to be judged. And yet Christ was judged for us, so that every time we let God down, if we turn to him in repentance, we will be forgiven. Well, you'll be glad to know we finally move on from complaining about food. They will come back to it in Numbers, but they finally move on. And in verses 8 to 16, we see that God provides the victory. The Amalekites come out to attack Israel. And you've got to remember the situation here. They're not really fit for battle. In their camp, there's women, there's children, there's old men. They aren't an organized fighting force. So what are they going to do? Well, Moses tells Joshua in chapter 17, verse 9, choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. If you've not been reading Exodus up to this point, that staff has been very important. It's not a magic staff, but it kind of represents God's presence with his people. So it was used in the 10 plagues, and it was also used as God parted the Red Sea. So it's a symbol of God's presence. So what we see here in chapter 17, verse 9, is that there's two strategies. One is there's the men Joshua was to choose. Presumably, they're a decent fighting force. They're going to be strong guys. They're going to have good swordsmanship. They're going to know what they're doing. But then secondly, there's going to be Moses standing on a hill and holding the staff of God. Which is going to make the difference? Verse 11. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But when he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. The key wasn't the warriors. The key was the staff. Now, as I've just said, that staff, there was nothing magic about it. What it represented was the people's trust in God. It was the symbol of God's power. So when it was lowered, it was as if God's power wasn't in the situation, and Israel began to be beaten back. God was teaching them a lesson through this, that they had to trust in him to provide victory, not to trust in their own human strength. When it was human strength alone, they lost. When God was involved, they won. How much do we need this in church life? I think something of our culture makes us struggle with trusting God to provide. Many of us work professional jobs, and we're used to the idea that if things aren't going wrong, we need to kind of get the whiteboard out and we need to come up with some ideas. And if we put our thinking caps on, eventually we'll figure out a way to solve the problem. And that leads us to approach church a bit like a business approaches marketing. We look and we try to see the things that are letting down our products, and we try to change things. But whilst that's very helpful in some ways, and we're not to do a rubbish job, just like Joshua and his army weren't to go dancing down there with no armor on and with no swords, that isn't ultimately the thing that brings success. The Lord is the one who gives the victory. Now, the equivalent of Moses' staff for us is prayer and the words. We can't change the message, it is what it is. And so we're to present that faithfully and relevantly, but present it nonetheless. And then we're to pray, we're going to rely on God to come through for us. Of course, we'll do everything that we can do as well as we can. But when we fall short, and we often will, we trust God to be the one who wins the victory for us. I was thinking recently about what happened at Easter for our family. Around the Easter period, the roof of our kitchen fell in. And so we had to leave our house. We had to move up the road to Knutsford to live with Nat's parents for the week, all in the midst of Easter, which, as a pastor, is quite a busy week. We had Good Friday. We had two services on Easter Sunday. And I said to Nat at the time, this is going to be an important weekend. I know that because it wouldn't be such a nightmare if it wasn't. And lo and behold, there was a couple who came into our church who were still coming along. And that was their second week with us. They'd been there on the Sunday before when these things had just happened. And through that, they heard the Easter message, and they've been coming ever since, come to a Christianity Explored course as well. And I love that that's the story, because it wasn't that we did some great amazing outreach that brought people in. I was struggling to get my sermons done because we'd had the roof of our house fall in. We hadn't done as good a job as we'd have liked to have done. But God was working nonetheless. I say this as much to myself as to you guys, but we need to have more faith that God can build his church rather than thinking it's all down to us. But you know, it's not just in church life that we need to learn that God brings the victory. We need the same in the sufferings we face as well. When we face suffering, our first thought is, I can't cope with that. And that's exactly right. We can't cope with it. We weren't made to cope with this. We were made for a perfect world without sin and without suffering. So when we face those things in our lives, we naturally feel we can't cope. We feel out of our depth because we are out of our depth. Human beings were not built for this kind of a world. But you know, we know someone who can deal with our greatest problems. Like Moses, we raise our hands to the heavens. We trust God to provide. We pray. We trust him. We rely on his words. That's what really changes things. We convince ourselves it can't possibly be true, but it is. We may need others to strengthen us for the task. There's this interesting moment in this passage where Moses is getting tired, and so Aaron and Hur start to hold up his arms, and maybe that's a good example of how we as a community are meant to strengthen each other in prayer and support. But we must continue to rely solely on God for the victory and not on human strength. Well, last of all, we see that God provides in the wisdom of others. Chapter 18, Jethro turns up on the scene. Jethro is Moses' father-in-law, and though it's not the main point of this passage, we shouldn't miss verses 10 to 11. Moses, in the passage that I've just skipped over, basically explains what happened in the Exodus to his father-in-law. And his father-in-law says, verse 10, "Praise be to the Lord, who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and who rescued the people from the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all of the gods, for he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly." Jethro, who isn't an Israelite, bear in mind, comes to see that the Lord is greater than all the other gods. And that is one of the chief purposes for God's work in the book of Exodus, and so it's a really important moment. But while Jethro's having a look around, and you know, Moses is maybe showing him the scenery, Jethro begins to observe that there's something wrong. To put it in modern terms, Moses is on the edge of burnout. The people have all of these problems, all of these needs, and Moses is sitting and judging every single one from morning until evening. Moses is telling them what God would have them do. From start to finish, no one else involved. And Moses' father-in-law gives him some good advice. "Rather than doing it all yourself, Moses, teach God's command to some trustworthy people in the community. The really tricky cases can come straight to you, because you probably know the word better than anyone else. But the day-to-day stuff, the easy stuff, well, why don't you let someone else handle?" He concludes in verse 23 by saying, "If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied." Well, what do we learn from this event? Well, for starters, Jethro's advice is just good advice that we can all learn from. I'm glad that at our church, I'm not like Moses doing everything. We need the work to be divided, both so that leaders, in Jethro's words, can stand the strain, and also so that the people can go home satisfied. Church life would be horrendous if Paul and Bob were doing everything. That's why we're called into a community. But this passage isn't just here to teach us the importance of delegation, as good as that is. It shows us one of the primary ways that God provides for us is through the wisdom of others. You know, God doesn't always send rescues through miracles from heaven. He doesn't always send manna. Sometimes he sends a Jethro. Sometimes he sends a brother or sister in Christ as a means of wisdom and grace to you. And that provision is no less amazing and no less divine. Let's face it, the story of Israel would have been very different if Moses had had a mental breakdown in the deserts. Sometimes we need people to come and give us good, solid advice. And we should see that not as their provision to us, but as God's provision for us through them. God called us to be churches for a reason. Here, in this room, you have brothers and sisters who've gone through things that you were going through, who have wise things to bear on your life. Seek out their wisdom. Don't be so self-sufficient that you fail to ask them for help. Often God works through the wisdom of others when we're looking for miracles to come from heaven. Well, as we close, I want to focus on those of you who are in a particularly tough place. You might feel let down. You might feel abandoned by God. What's the lesson from this passage? Well, firstly, God provides in trials. Trials aren't the absence of God, they're the presence of God. Whatever our circumstances, we can trust God to come through for us. Secondly, God provides our daily bread. He gives us what we need to get through each individual day, keeping us dependent on him. Look at the problems of your day and ask God to help then, rather than worrying about all the days that are to come. Thirdly, God provides more than we deserve. You may realize that you're like the Israelites, always failing to trust God, always failing to hear his challenge. Yet because Jesus was struck, you can be given living water that you simply don't deserve. Fourthly, God provides victory. Whatever you need, reliance on him is more important than your own strength. Bring your need to God in prayer. Keep your arms raised to heaven like Moses did in that battle. And then fifthly, God provides in the wisdom of others. Trying to go through these things alone is more than anyone can bear. Just like Moses, we need Jethro's. We need the assistant judges. We need the support of others for the challenges we face. This is a means by which the loving God can give you what you need. Life as a follower of Jesus is never, ever easy. But in the midst of the troubles we face, if we turn to him and trust in him, we will see that the Lord truly does provide.